ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Thanks for coming today. You found yourself at a conscious living event, and we have these monthly talks with Vishesh Vyasa here. Stay tuned, and if you're not already a member of the Conscious Living at Salesforce Group, you know where to find it now. You can ask either myself, Sarah Chan, and Manu, who started this group a couple years ago. So a little bit about Vishesh Kadasa. He is a veteran monk, author, and spiritual guide who has traveled throughout the world sharing his knowledge gained from over four decades with bhakti yoga practice and his dedication to spiritual entrepreneurialism. Speaking at corporations, universities, and nonprofits, he has taught universal principles of personal spiritual development, which I love that topic, and I imagine you do too since you're here. And renowned for his wisdom and his inspiring speech, he has the ability to make ancient yoga wisdom and practices relevant and accessible for us in our modern world today. So let's give Vishesh Kadasa a warm welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here always. I love coming to Salesforce. It's a very bright place with very bright people. And I've always appreciated the work of the founder of the organization, who's a very enlightened type person. So thank you for being here. Let's start with a little bit of meditation together, just to get centered, because as we're moving about, there's a lot of energy that we can channel into one place and then feel more centered and focused. And so if you'll just find a comfortable way to sit, and if you straighten your spine just slightly more than you were when you first came in, you'll notice that your mind comes to attention. Interesting phenomena, because there's a way in which all the senses, when they notice that your spine straightens, they suddenly think something important is about to happen. That's why when you go to an interview, you usually sit up straight rather than going like this, because the interviewer will take you more seriously. And if you would close your eyes and just come into the present, which is a place that we often don't live. Today we'll be talking about the mind, which is actually a thing, and it's something that we live with all the time, but we may not get a chance to analyze it because we're just going along with it and not observing what it is or what its potential is. And one of the ways to do that is through simple introspection. There doesn't have to be anything extremely fancy about meditation. It really has to do with introspection. Spect means to see. And how often do I see who I actually am inside? As I'm looking outside and I'm noticing what I'm doing and thinking about what I'm about to do and oftentimes lamenting about what I did or didn't do in the past. So take a minute to unburden yourself by just being here. Sometimes people, when they meet you, will ask you, what have you been doing? And that brings up the question, are you a human being or a human doing? So for a few minutes, just be a human being, and just be, because that's good enough. And as you're sitting comfortably with your spine a little straight, bring your attention to your breath and just notice and be grateful for the fact that you have the air of life coming in and out, prana energy. It's all around us. I take it for granted all day long that I get this free air. But if any time the air supply gets interrupted, even for 10 seconds, then I go into panic mode. That's how dependent I am on this prana energy that I'm taking in at every second. So if you can watch your breath and be grateful for it and appreciate the fact that you can breathe and it's a gift. And as you relax even more, and you notice your breath, to help keep your mind fixed in one place, when you exhale, just mentally say out. And when you inhale, say in. And if your mind goes off somewhere, like to the external noises, just gently bring it back to your breath and to the awareness that you're right here, right now, in a safe place. In the practice of meditation, there's many places that the ancient wisdom texts recommend that you focus your mind. One of them is on the breath. And the other is on a mantra. Man means mind, and tra means to focus or to deliver the mind from its ruminations. It moves from one place to the next without warning. So being able to calm the mind and fix it on one place has an extremely beneficial effect on us and allows us to see a little bit more what's inside, which is us. We're the consciousness within, and that consciousness pervades every part of our body. And one of the mantras that helps to fix the mind is two syllables. First is Ra, second one is Ma. So together it's Ra-Ma. For many thousands of years, yogis have meditated on these two syllables. So as you're focusing, see the two syllables. Ra, R-A-M-A, Ra-Ma. And keep your attention fixed on the mantra, Ra-Ma. And now in mantra meditation, you can actually vocalize the mantra. That involves some of the other senses. So I'll say the mantra out loud once, and then when I say it the second time, if you wish, you can join in vocally and just follow my lead. And we'll say it four times and just focus on the syllables Rama as you utter them from your own mouth. Rama, 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 Rama. And bring your attention back to your breathing. And just notice for a moment if there are any movements in your mind, if it's going from one place to the next. And if you like, please rub your palms together. And you can hold your hands right in front of your face by about 6 inches, and then open your eyes, look into the palms of your hands, and then gradually bring your awareness back to the room. And welcome back. It's helpful to take a little time every day to look inwardly. Has anybody ever told you, don't shop when you're hungry? I've made that mistake a few times. I end up bringing back way too much. So I don't have the right perspective, as I have a hunger, I look at everything and I think, oh, I could eat that. So in a similar way, I like to say that start your day with a little bit of inner fulfillment. Don't go out hungry for all kinds of things, because you'll start relationships and grab onto things that you don't really need. If you're experiencing a little bit of fullness in yourself, you've already noticed that you don't really have to become something as much as realize that you already are something. It's one of the focus points in bhakti yoga, is first realizing that you're a conscious being. And in Sanskrit, and I'll refer to this as we go forward and talking about the mind, the self is called the Atma. And it's different from the mind. The Atma, or the conscious self, can be conscious of itself, and it can also be conscious of its of the mind. The mind is a tool that we bring with us wherever we go. So first, let's start, before I go into the page that I'm going to describe here, that just at the top says mind, and I think you'll find it on your third page. Because I haven't heard from any of you yet, because I haven't asked for anything yet, but I thought it would be helpful if any of you could just reflect back what it was like to take 5 minutes to introspect. Did you have any particular, doesn't have to be anything outlandish or spectacular, but the experience itself, did you feel resistant, or was it something that, did you have any kind of experience that you brought back with you? Yes. We're going to pass the mic around, because that way everyone hears it, and I'm also recording, so that way that the people who are listening can hear your voice too. Okay.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Sophia.
Thank you for that. I noticed that saying Rama made me feel more connected internally.
Good. And that's the idea behind the mantra. The mantra has its own potency. When you use the mantra in mantra meditation, you have an ally when you're meditating. If you're just looking at the wall or at a candle flame, or you're watching your own breath, sometimes it's you and an inanimate object. But with Rama, there's some special spiritual potency. Thank you. What else? You're smiling, so you're ready to go.
Hi there. It's something that I noticed. It's funny because I just feel so American that the in and out is what really hit home for me. Like I've done kirtan before, with like singing, yelling the ra's, and like I have felt that. But when I just allowed myself to think of it as not just breathing, because I often will count when I'm breathing, but the in and the out. just made me feel like that prana energy in more than just like taking a deep breath.
Nice. I'm glad. Excellent. And what is your name?
Mia.
Mia mentioned kirtan, so I just thought I'd give a footnote to that. It's a kind of meditation that's done in a group setting. Like if we were to do kirtan in here, we wouldn't have to, but move into a circle more. And then it's singing the mantra. There are different mantras you can sing, and then there's a call and respond. And it can be quite absorbing, and it's also using the mantra for meditation, but you kind of get the benefit of the group in singing the mantra. So that's what she was referring to. And in mantra meditation, there's also this other way of using the mantra, was called japa. Everyone say japa.
Japa.
Japa. So japa means it's a quiet meditation. You do it for yourself. Kirtan's loud, as Mia said, and it's like it is singing. But japa is your own private meditation. So you say the mantra, but just loud enough so you can hear it, just under your breath. And then you can keep concentrating on the mantra. Oftentimes, we use beads to count how many mantras we're doing. And that way you can keep a steady practice. Anybody else? Just give me one more, and I'll be satisfied. Yes, please.
So, like, the stuff that I'm concerned about most at the moment, like, magnifies itself and shows up right in front of me. Like, the stuff that you avoid and it's in your subconscious, when you actually go quiet and eyes closed, then that kind of, you have to kind of confront it.
Yeah. And you could use the word confront, you could also say acknowledge. And until actually I acknowledge the various kinds of thought energy that are going through my mind, I basically become unaware of it. And I just assume that that's who I am. So there's a distinction that one can notice when one introspects. And that is, there's my life, which is actually my conscious self that's always in the present. And then there's my life situation. And the two are completely different, because my life situation isn't really me. It's just something that's going on around me. And when I become absorbed in my life situation, I think, this is me. This is where I start to feel threatened or pushed, or there's a lot of tension and anxiety. And we'll talk about that in just a minute when it comes to the mind and how to adjust the mind's algorithms. Thank you for the insights that you shared back. So, in thinking about algorithms, which I don't really know that much about, except for now when I studied it a little bit more, I see that it's a kind of a simple concept. Actually, it came from a person whose name in Arabic sounds a little bit like algorithm, and it was Latinized. I thought it was some, you know, algorithm, like something very scientific, but it's actually somebody's name who thought of the concept of algorithms in the first place. And it's really, as all of you know more than I do, it's really a formula that's iterated in order to solve a problem, to put it in its simplest form. And when I was thinking about algorithms, because they're so prevalent nowadays, there's ways in which they're programmed into our networks that we look at here and there, and we notice that things sort of happen automatically. One of the most notable things in the last 10 years, I guess, is that whenever I look at something, say if I looked at a suitcase, you know, for the next 2 weeks, there's suitcases following me wherever I go. Because there's some machine that was trained to notice that I had noticed something, and then it keeps following me. But I noticed also that in the bhakti scriptures, they talk about meditation and describe the mind and the way it works. Those types of algorithms are already naturally all around us. And for instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, it's mentioned that when you contemplate something in the world, then it tends to attach itself to you. It's called dhyayato vishayam pum sang sangas teshu bhajayate. So the word sangha in Sanskrit means that you make a connection with it. And once you do, that may be good or it may be a problem for you. And how do you make a connection with it? By dhyayata, actually, is a word that really means a meditation or contemplation. So you look at something anywhere in the world, and then all of a sudden you attach to it, and it becomes part of you. That's what sangha means. And it kind of follows you around, and then you identify with that object. So there's obviously built-in algorithms within our mind. One of the objectives of yoga and meditation is to amend the algorithms we have. So let's go into this first page on the mind. And here I give an acronym, M-I-N-D, the word mind, to describe various situations of the mind. And the first one is to notice that it's mystical. Oftentimes I take it for granted, but it's actually a very fascinating organ, which even modern science doesn't know that much about. Although they're poking around there to try to figure it out, it's a little bit mysterious. So John Milton, the poet, as you most of you know, said the mind is a universe that can make a heaven out of hell or a hell out of heaven. So I've given a scenario here, which I'll ask somebody to read. Who would like to read this out loud and become famous for the rest of their life for reading? Go ahead, you'll do it. Okay, give him the mic. Now give him a hand, because now he's famous. Just for volunteering. volunteering, he gets.
In anticipation, you attend an event after learning that there will be cheesecake served for dessert. When the event is over, you find out that due to a glitch with the caterers, there will be no cheesecake served. Suddenly, our anticipation of happiness turns into lamentation. At the same event, a diabetic who loves cheesecake suddenly feels happy when she hears there will be no cheesecake. She had been lamenting that she'd not be able to eat it.
So this is a commonplace example, but something that we can certainly relate to. The two people in the same situation, and because they have different minds, they interpret it differently. And so I've written here, the mind is mystical as it determines our experiences regardless of the circumstances. This is really a widely expressed principle. You go into self-help anywhere, and you'll find this is the basis of it. The mantra for helping yourself, it's not what happens to you, it's what you do about what happens to you. But we're going a little deeper into the mechanics of that in talking about algorithms of the mind. What is it that makes my mind interpret my environment or what just happened to me in a certain way? And obviously, it can be completely opposite. One person doesn't get the cheesecake and is lamenting. The other person doesn't get the cheesecake and is thinking, oh, great, things are going my way. Okay, so number two, first one is that it's mystical. Please say mystical.
Mystical.
That's the M in mind. The second one is impressionable. Who would read the next one? Go ahead. Here, give them the mic real quick. Can you fix the mic for him, please? Yeah. Okay.
You fixed it. Impressionable. Our past actions form impressions on our mind. Whatever we do, especially repeatedly, gets impressed on the mind. These impressions become the bases of our perceptions, biases, and aspirations. What to speak of our anxieties and fears.
Okay, so thank you very much. Appreciate it. I just have this sequence here. And as when we're speaking of algorithms, we're speaking of sequences. And we have past actions lead to impressions, lead to perception, biases, aspirations, and leads to future actions. So it's the way in which I'm reacting to the world because of the impressions that are in my mind, and that determines how I work in the world. And this has everything to do with how I'm moving forward and what my fortune will be one way or the other. So I've written here, by understanding the impressionable qualities of the mind, we can begin to understand our emotions. So there's more to say about these basic principles, but I wanted to emblazon them through this acronym that the mind is impressionable. And that is something to be aware of as we move about the world. One of the examples I've given frequently is a revelation I had one day when I was walking in the area where I live on the peninsula. And I noticed that all of the storm drains have a little placard above them that say, no dumping drains to bay. Have you ever noticed that? It has a fish on it. And then I was thinking about how that is, that several miles from the bay, anything you put in will go by finding the, it will go through the water system and it ends up in the bay. Water seeks its own level. And then I started thinking about how my ears are like those storm drains. And whatever I put in here drains into the mental system, and it stays in there. So you have to be a little careful because the mind is impressionable. And whatever you put in will stay in, and it will have effect. So the third one is the mind is neutral. What's the first one?
Mystical.
Second?
Impressionable.
And the third is neutral. So the mind only gives back to us what we put into it. Inputs create impressions in the mind. Changing your input changes your impressions, which reshapes your mind. The neutrality of the mind can be equated to the property of the blotting paper. And that's another analogy we'll go a little more into in just a minute. And in this regard, the Bhagavad Gita, which speaks a lot about meditation, says, the mind can be our friend or our enemy. It is intrinsically neutral. A person may take responsibility to elevate his or her own mind. So it has a neutral quality to it, but the way that we interact with the mind, or even the way that we discipline ourselves in our minds, will determine whether the mind has good algorithms or bad algorithms. And that makes all the difference in the world. So keep in mind that you only get one mind you've been given. So it's a good idea to take good care of it. And then the fourth is, the mind is directable. D is for? The mind can be directed and reformed by mode of goodness lifestyle changes, karma yoga and mantra meditation. So there are very specific prescriptions for amending the mind's algorithms that are given in many of the wisdom literatures. And some of them I've mentioned here and I'll talk about a little bit later. And then a quote that I really like from one of the really ancient books called the Bhagavat Purana. And it tells a story of a man who was a very rich person, and he was a miser, and he ended up losing everything and sort of wandering the world as a holy person, and everybody just thought he was a cheater, so they berated him and they disregarded him altogether. But he was so internally focused that he didn't even mind. He sort of rose above it all. And in the course of the teaching about this person called the Avanti Brahmana, there's a verse about the mind. And it says, all the senses have been under the control of the mind since time immemorial. And the mind himself never comes under the sway of any other. He is stronger than the strongest, and his godlike power is fearsome. Therefore, anyone who can bring the mind under control becomes the master of all the senses. How does that verse strike you? He's got some snaps. Thank you. What did you like about it? Quick.
I like how it talked about...
Wait, we don't want to miss even one word. This is important. Is that mic troublesome, or is that... the way they're all designed. Okay, then let's use the other one. Okay, go ahead.
Hi everyone, my name's Andrea. I like how it talked about, basically it's mind over matter. What you think you become, what you think you attract as well, is what I took from it.
Yeah.
And it's very powerful.
Yes. I read a book called The War of Art. And no, it's not The Art of War, although there is a title called The Art of War. But it's called The War of Art. I read it when I was writing my last book, and I had gone into that kind of pattern where I'd go to the library to look up book information about how to write a book rather than writing the book. And in this particular book, which I thought was brilliant, the author, who's an author, spoke about writing. And he said that there is a force in the world called resistance, and he spells it with a capital R. When you sit down to be creative, you stare at a blank screen and you start to write, as an example, or any other creative endeavor, then this force of resistance grips you and forces you to do anything else but that. I become really productive in my life when I know I have a deadline to finish writing something. I'll do anything but write. And so that very strong force is always there. And being aware of it, and that by being able to actually channel that energy of the mind, that resistance, and through the practice of yoga, gives you a distinct advantage in life, because the mind otherwise is formidable, and the results can be onerous. So now I'm going to the next page to actually deal with some of the ideas that we talked about before. And at the top of this page, it says amending the mind's algorithms. So one thing I find hopeful about the whole prospect of dealing with the resistance of the mind is it's altogether amendable. There's a way in which the mind is meant to be amended, and that's one of the ideas behind yoga altogether, is to bring the mind to a friendly relationship with us. Now in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says the mind can be your best friend or your worst enemy. Yeah, so when the mind's uncontrolled and unruly, it can be worst enemy. And I'm sure if we took scenarios, we could name quite a few scenarios where the mind, even in our own lives, has been challenging. But when you make it your friend, then it's the best ally that you can have. So there are a few analogies that help to understand what the mind is. One of them is a modern analogy, that is the mind as a computer. So in this scenario, there's hardware, which is actually the physical shape of the brain, and then there's the software, which is the subtle energy that runs through the mind. I mean, the body is there, we have a physical body, but the Vedas, the ancient books of wisdom on yoga, describe how there's the subtle energy called mind, which is actually a material energy, but it's extremely subtle, is like the software. So you need the software to run the hardware, but there also has to be a user. So the user is described as the Atma, and I referred to that at the very beginning of the talk. The Atma is our conscious self, the cognitive self. And the Atma is, according to the Vedas, a non-material particle. It's not the same category of energy as the mind or as the physical body, the gross physical body. It's altogether different. And it's actually the observer. When you look at somebody and somebody's looking back at you, if you dare, why don't you try it for a second? I mean, there's a palpable energy when you look at somebody, you're like, boom, you get hit by something. What is that? I was just in Japan, and I was walking up this really steep hill in Okinawa, and there was a man coming down really slowly, because it's a very steep hill in a tiny little pickup truck. He must have been in his 60s, and you know, I had my head down walking up the hill, and he looked up, I looked up at the same time, and our eyes caught each other's eyes, and as is the tradition in Japan, he just kind of bowed his head like that. Because he saw me, our eyes, and he went like this. And then I went like that. And as I was walking up the hill, I was thinking of what just happened. Something happened. That it wasn't nothing. There was cognition. And the word acknowledgement came into my mind as I walked up the hill. So I looked it up when I got back to the place I was staying, and I was thinking about acknowledgement. And who's doing the acknowledging? This is the Atma, who's the conscious, aware being that's within the body. And so that's the user of the hardware and the software. Without that, if you take out the Atma, then the whole thing just goes dark. That's where the light is, and that's where the cognition is. And that's kind of mysterious, isn't it? What do you think? Okay. I'm going to go to the next one. But the next time, we'll take some reflections. So the next one is giving analogies just to give a composite of what the mind is and be really aware of what we're working with. It's also like a lens. So let's just imagine we're in a building. Of course, we are, so it's not hard to imagine. But let's just say there's 5 security cameras around the perimeter of this building down below. And they all come up into one room. That is, the information they're collecting comes up. And then there's 5 television sets, and there's a person sitting behind a desk looking at all the 5 TV screens. Now, I've just given you an analogy. You know, please tell me what the efficacy of that or the meaning of that analogy is in relationship to the mind and the Atma. It's a challenge, and it's worth 20 points. Okay? Yes.
maybe it's in reference to the fact that it's not what is happening on the screens or outside of the building that is meaningful, but what the person sitting at the screens watching them decides the meaning is.
That's very true. That's very true. But think in terms of five. Okay, go ahead. Why five screens and five?
Those are the five sets.
Yes.
So you can get sensory inputs, and then my next one.
Okay, notice grouped around your head. Although we look in the mirror and we think, oh, I wonder how I look. Yeah, these are actually functioning portals on the outside. Very high tech, you know. You've got your eyes, your nose, your mouth, your ears, and then, of course, there's a sense of touch. These are all gathering information from around your environment at every second. And they're like little cameras in this analogy that are pointing outwards into the world. And it all comes up through one system, and then who's looking at those five screens? In our analogy, it was a security guard, right? So let's say he's looking into the screens, and all of a sudden he sees an intruder coming in through one of the side doors. And they immediately zooms in to that one screen. So let's say we're sitting here talking, and all of a sudden a bee stings you on your leg. Then you're no longer conscious of our conversation, but you're conscious now over here because your mind just went to another screen. So all the screens are coming in at all the time. The information is coming in through these five different screens. These are little cameras, obviously. These are also information portals that are taking in all kinds of information, and it's getting translated through a very complex network, and it's coming in, and then you're sitting there and you're observing all this kind of stuff. And you become more or less aware of a particular screen that comes in according to your need and your purpose. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Keep going. Two people said yes. Three, four, five?
Yes.
Okay. Everybody else cover your ears. Just kidding. Okay, next, the mind is very, very frequently in the ancient yoga literature is referred to as a horse. Why do you think that is? Where is a similarity between the mind and a horse?
Emotions.
What is it?
Emotions.
Emotions? Yes. You said emotions.
Well, I think it's connected. I heard that analogy.
Yeah, well, I think it's really helpful that you said that. Cause anybody here have a horse? You don't keep one in the city? Keep it in the city. Okay, so horses, they're very sensitive. And in fact, we've all heard of horse whisperers, right? Please say yes.
Yes.
Yeah, horse whisperers, there are people that can talk to horses and they gain their confidence and they bring them closer. And after a while, the horse starts to trust the horse whisperer, and the horse whisperer says, you know, humans are okay and we can work together. And the horse says, okay, we can work together. And then it takes a little practice or a lot of practice for the horse. For instance, if a rider mounts the horse and then says, you know, let's go right, and the horse says, not right now, and then the rider says, no, right now. there's a learning curve between the rider and the horse. So in a similar way, the mind is compared to a horse. Now, when I said it could be your best friend or your worst enemy, there's a way in which if you have a horse and you get on it and it just goes any direction it wants to go, if you don't mind where you're going, if you go anywhere, then you won't really notice, right? You get on the horse and it's like, wherever you want to go, it's up to you, you just go. And you'll never notice that the horse has a mind of its own. But if you want to go from this side of your farm to the other, and you say, horse, we got to go a little bit southeast, and then you have to apply a little pressure and say, you know, not that I'm a horse rider, I'm just imitating. And then the horse will start to go in a certain direction. So when we begin to train the mind, let's say through meditation, that's when we'll start to notice this capital R resistance. As the mind will start to take off in different ways and say, I don't want to sit down right now. I want to look at a screen somewhere. Give me screen time. And it's like, we're not having screen time right now. It's like, no, I need it now because it's really important. And in fact, I was sitting this morning reading and I was thinking about breaking news. Do any of you hear about breaking news? I would be very impressed if none of you tune into the news. But everywhere it's called breaking news, right? So I was thinking, breaking news means breaking your concentration from what's actually important. Or breaking your heart about hearing all kinds of things that you can do absolutely nothing about, And you just sit there with a broken heart, kind of like, how could this happen? And what are you going to do about it? So that's what breaking news means. I just threw that in as an extra. So the horse can be tamed. And then when there's a relationship to a horse and a human, it's a very beautiful thing, actually. They love each other. They work together. There's synergy. So our mind is compared very frequently to a horse. And you have to learn how to be a horse whisperer or a mind whisperer. You have to bring the mind on your side so that it can be friendly. Then you've really got an ally. Or you've got the horror movie. That's the next one. Somebody tell me about it. What's this one doing there? Why do we have an analogy of the mind as a horror movie? Work with me. Yes, give her the mic. Say a little more about that. Be descriptive.
Because we have lots of imagination.
Yeah, that's very philosophical. But
make our fears seem realistic.
Yes. Can you give us a scenario? Have you ever run a horror movie in your mind and watched it and freaked out because you watched it?
Yes.
Yeah, you have done? You've done? Can you want to tell us? Here we got a very willing volunteer in the back. Yes, go ahead and then he'll say.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying, like, you know, I think we're kind of trained just to think of like a worst case scenario.
Yeah.
In general, we're prepared, I think.
Yes.
I think it's just the human condition in general, just to kind of understand what all the options are. But obviously, like, not go into that one direction.
Yes.
But sometimes you can get stuck there too.
Yes, you can. Some people call it catastrophizing. As soon as something happens, or you imagine, even in calm times, you imagine how an earthquake's going to come, the whole house will be knocked down, and, you know, all kinds of things will happen. Yes?
Yeah, I just think of it more from, like, a sales perspective, you know, just like a deal. You know, some, I get some news that they may have had a comment or something happened or changed. I start, like, picturing.
I'm repeating so they can hear online, but he's saying, like, in a sales environment, where something just changed, and then all of a sudden you start thinking.
That may not close, or it may not push.
It may not close.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't close, then what?
Then
your
manager asks. Like,
then your manager, and then.
I mean, my quota.
Yeah, it goes in a cascade. I mean, it can go all the way from, for like, you know, we're not going to make our first Q1 quota, and next thing you know, I'm out on the street homeless, and everybody hates me. It can really go that the mind is really expert at that in presenting a horror movie. So, and you were going to say?
Yeah, around the same lines. You know, I certainly kind of personally attest to, you know, having an anxiety-driven mind in which you're going down these dark rabbit holes that seemingly don't end. But I was going to use the breaking news analogy in which, you know, our mind can be trained to glass half full or glass half empty.
Yes.
Type of perspective. That's the song. Sorry. And so, in this, yeah, this mic's giving me some grief. Half on, half off. What I was going to say is, in taking even like breaking news, for example, any day we can just assume, oh my gosh, the country's going to shambles, like, headed in the wrong direction, we're going to be out on the street, I need to leave the country, or we can focus on things that we actually do have control over.
Yes.
That we can make an impact around. And in those senses, we can avoid those horror stories or horror films.
Yes. Together. You make excellent points. And this is much to the point of the presentation, is that it's all amendable. It takes practice, but it is amendable. Left to its own devices, the mind does tend to show horror movies and so forth, and some people are predisposed to that more than others. Nonetheless, it's a tendency that we can overcome by some of the ways you're talking about and some that we'll talk about in a few minutes. Yes?
Yeah, mindfulness.
Please fix the mic. Can't hear him. We need a constant tech there.
In mindfulness, they tell us to be cognizant of the present moment, but mind lets us either to the past or failures of the past,
yes,
or the unseen, I mean, fear of the future, right?
That's where we kind of gravitate all the time.
Yes.
And so we should be focusing on the present, like meditation teaches us that.
Yeah, so he's saying that we should focus on the present. And why should we focus on the present? Because that's reality. We actually only live in the present. The movie that I show myself from the past or what that I project into the future is the stuff of fantasy, actually. In fact, people have looked into this as far as the categories of different kinds of worries and have ascertained that the things we worry about generally don't happen. We do catastrophize, but they don't happen. But you'll notice, even in the middle of a catastrophe, if you notice that you're right in the moment, you're okay right at that minute. Even though everything may be changing around you in a drastic way, which is what we call catastrophe, the world seems to be moving against us, against our plan. I have a plan. Does it ever work? Not really. Because the world's moving in an opposite way at some point or another. And then I consider that to be a disaster, really. And when it moves really fast, it's a disaster. When it moves slow, it's just sort of the regular grind of life. So this idea of understanding that the point of power is always in the present moment. I can only deal with something right now. I can't deal with it yesterday or 10 years ago, or I can't deal with it in the future. I can actually only deal with it right now. So one of the best time management mantras I've ever heard is, what's the best use of my time right now? Please say.
What is the best use of my time right now?
Say one more time.
What's the best use of my time right now?
That's kind of a mindfulness meditation also, although it has to do with, you know, doing something. The fact is that I'm only ever right now, and coming into that point of the present is extremely centering, because that's where we actually live. So the horror movie can be changed, and we can put up a different movie. It's very difficult to ignore the movie. It's like I fly a lot, and when I'm on these planes, especially at night, there's TV sets all over the place. And as soon as I open my eyes, my eyes just go right to one of the screens somewhere. And it's like, come on, back here. It's like, nope. So it's difficult for the eye not to engage in something unless you give it a superior look. You give it a better movie to deal with. And finally, we have this example of a blotting paper. And a blotting paper is extremely highly absorbent, and it picks up whatever you put in front of it, whatever you put on it, it pulls in. So the mind is like that also, and I mentioned that earlier in the analogy that I had discovered in my neighborhood with a water from the suburbs draining into the bay. Everything that we put near the mind, it picks up. So you have to be aware of the fact that it's absorbing things. Be careful what you put into it. So Dr. Anna Powers, who's done a lot of scientific research about the mind and how it works, I just pulled out one paragraph from her, and if so, would you read it for us? Here, just give him this. It's right at the bottom. Bottom. Show him where it is. There.
Our perception.
Oh, goodness.
Our perception of life and the events we gravitate toward is largely defined by the signals our brain receives from us in the form of data it receives, both in terms of concrete events and the emotions we associate with them. Consequently, if we want to make changes, we have to start feeding our mind with different data.
That makes sense, right? Thank you for doing that. I just thought I'd put that in for authenticity. There's a lot of ways that scientifically minded people are thinking about the way the mind absorbs things from its environment. And it's a kind of very practical matter of changing what you put in. Like, I often like to say, if you don't like what you're being subjected to in the world, then change the subject. Because you get to choose which channel you're tuned into. And if you notice that you're watching a certain channel and it's really agitating your mind, like, change the channel. I'm not talking about television, if it even still exists, I'm not sure. Okay, so aspects of the mind. I've mentioned this in previous classes, but I'll go through it again because it's very practical. The first is called perception. The mind perceives things, but it only perceives when you're actually focused on it. And I'll give you an example. If you're reading, and you start thinking about your tax returns instead of the paragraph you're focused on. Your eye might be reading the words, but your mind is thinking about when the deadline is for your taxes. And I'm sorry to bring that up. But I do it for effect, because it is something where the heart kind of skips a beat and it goes a little faster, and it's like, oh, I didn't do my tax returns yet and now I have to deal with it and so forth. So unless you're actually focused on something, you don't perceive it. That's one of the first principles of the mind. And the second is interpretation. This is very important, because whatever comes into our minds, we interpret. And according to the Vedas, mind can be in various conditions, and they're called modalities. One of them is called sattva, or in a very clear and transparent mode. And the next one is called rajas, which is a passionate mode, where it's always thinking about how to do something more, how to get ahead. And no matter what you have, it's not enough. And then the lowest energy is called tamas. It's an energy of inertia, where you tend to not move, even though you know you need to. And you may also be in a state of depression in this kind of mode. So these modalities, according to the yoga literatures, are pervade the world, and we become conditioned by them, and so does our mind, especially our mind. And therefore, whatever comes in through the senses and our mind interprets, it interprets based on the condition of the mind at the time that it's interpreting it. Therefore, I've added this quote from Epictetus, who said, "You're not upset about what happens to you, but about what you think happens to you." This is the law of interpretation. And then the next thing that happens when I interpret something is my body goes through changes. For instance, if I'm sitting in my house and all of a sudden I hear a smashing sound outside my house and I interpret it that my car just got hit, then I start to go through bodily changes. I perspire. My breath starts to speed up and so forth. Then I go to the window and I look out and I notice that it wasn't my car, it was my neighbor's car. Now what happens? My heart rate goes back down. I feel fine. Okay, so it's a car is a car, but one of them's my car, and I'm interpreting it like that because it's glass and metal, but I'm saying this is my car. So it's an interpretation of my environment that causes me the anxiety. It's the way I'm looking at the information that's coming in. And then finally, very interesting phenomenon is that is once the body goes through its changes, then it sends it back to the mind, and the mind then says, look how many changes the body's going through. It must be true. Like when you get an anxiety and it starts to change your bodily functions, and then your mind picks it up and goes, this really is trouble. Because otherwise, why would I be breathing so heavily and why would I be perspiring and so forth if it wasn't big trouble? And this creates a cycle that the mind goes through, these various stages. So how about amending the mind's algorithms? One of the processes that's well practiced is called DSI. It's called deliberate spiritual intelligence. It means to do what we started with doing in the class, is looking inwardly and finding out your core. Who am I actually beyond the machinations of the mind and the changes that are going on within my body? And we are actually able to observe what that entity is, that is you, and see who you are, and also hear from various authoritative sources about the hierarchy that goes on within my own being. For instance, lowest of all is the senses, above the senses is the mind, above the mind is the intellect, and above the intellect is the atma, or the self. Am I going too fast? I'm kind of speeding up because I'm aware the end is near. Not in any apocalyptic way, but just of the class, I'm hoping. And so this DSI, a lot of it has to do with what's called deliberation. Taking time to actually observe who you are and what's actually going on in the world, because there is a possibility, as I said earlier, I can become so absorbed in my life situation, I take everything for granted, and I never take time to actually analyze or dissect it. But deliberation means, one of the aspects of deliberation is to consider the consequences of everything I'm doing, and to look at it very carefully and objectively. And when I'm able to do that, it prepares me for dealing with my interpretations and my mind's interpretations when they come to me. Did that make sense at all? What about it made sense? Somebody tell me. What aspect stuck to you? You want to say? Okay, 1, 2. Go quick, we're running out of time.
Can you hear me?
Nope.
All right, I'll just speak up. Yeah, something that stuck out to me was the interpretation piece.
Yes. Yes.
And so, in speaking to the acceptance piece, I think that's in which we rectify or come to terms with that interpretation and either believe it to be true or make some sense of truth.
Thank you. Very helpful. It's acknowledging that there is a process is part of deliberation. And when you notice it in your own mind that it's going through this process and you're able to step back even a tiny bit and observe what's happening, it's not that you're carried away by it, but you're actually able to acknowledge it. It's that perspective that really helps. I'm going to keep going and then take it at the end because I want to go more into amending the mind's algorithms. So one of them really is taking time to analyze through the various studies and the ancient wisdom literatures that describe the mind and the way it works and what the consequences of various interpretations of the mind leads to is very helpful in keeping the mind prepared. Also keeping in mind that there are bad algorithms and good algorithms. So if you enact a bad algorithm, what happens? Bad stuff. Okay. And if you enact a good algorithm, what happens? Good stuff. Right. I'll give you an example that Jim Rohn used to give. An apple a day. You finish the sentence. Okay. That's made it all the way here to San Francisco. So apple a day keeps the doctor away. So then if you change that's an algorithm. Now if I change that algorithm and I say a Hershey's bar a day, and then you say keeps the doctor away, that doesn't work, does it? I guarantee you it doesn't. I've tried it. No, just kidding. it doesn't work. But the point is, if you make a slight error in your algorithm in your life, and the way your mind's working, you're interpreting things, or the way you're carrying out various habits in your life, you get the wrong algorithm, and then the next thing you know, you've got a result that you have to live with, a consequence that you didn't really like or desire at all. So there are anxiety algorithms. One of them is I'm not good enough. A lot of this sometimes comes from our upbringing. Someone might tell us, a teacher or a parent or something like that who is very cruel, who might say, you're no good. And that starts a little algorithm that continues to run throughout my life, and whenever anything comes up, I think I'm no good. Amended, it's I'm a spiritual being beyond the physical body. What I am is already amazing. The fact is that if I'm aware of my actual conscious self and see who I am, experience who I am for myself, the various conditionings of I'm not good enough tend to fade very quickly. Then we have I need things to make me complete, which is an algorithm which is constantly running, especially nowadays, whereas the amended version is relationships make me happy, not things. Some of the habits I've listed at the bottom of the page, which are the stuff of yoga practice. There are certain, what it's called, spiritual fitness. Keeping oneself spiritually fit in body, mind, and in spirit has a rhythm to it, and there's actually a practice. One of them, just in concluding, is cultivating sattva habits. The way we eat, the way we sleep, the way we interact with the world. There are very specific habits which are called sattva, which I mentioned before is a very lucid and energy-giving modality. And then there's karma yoga, which is using one's work for enlightenment. Not working simply for profit, but thinking, how can I do service with my work? I think, as I mentioned earlier, the CEO of this company has picked up this algorithm early on and has actually been a leader in the corporate community, showing people that, you know, you just don't have a corporate entity just for selfish profit, but you actually use it to help people, right? So this is called karma yoga, and it's a very enlightening and amending kind of a way to work. It actually affects the algorithms of the mind. And then finally, in bhakti yoga, which is the yoga of love and gratitude for our divine source, there are practices that we started with, like mantra meditation, which put us in direct touch with that spiritual stratum. And when we can experience it on a regular basis, then we become more aware of the way our minds are working and more equipped to actually deal with the algorithms and help to amend them. And that is a primer on adjusting or amending the algorithms of the mind. And thank you for giving your kind attention. And I mean that in the deepest sense, because all we really have in our life, ultimately, that we get to keep is our attention. And we get to decide where to put it. And I'm deeply touched that you came here today and gave me such a huge amount of time to sit and listen and give rapt attention. So thank you. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Vaisheshika, for such an enlightening talk. And thanks to all of you for coming, and online audience also. Before you grab, if you have not joined our chat app, with Conscious Living at Salesforce, please join. We also have a snack. And
use the other mic. It's behind you. Here. We're gonna beat this. There you go.
Please feel free to grab a snack before you leave. We also have next is optional meditation workshop, and Vaisheshika is going to introduce us to this mantra meditation and the mantra of peace. So we can just join. And also, if you have questions, feel free to stay behind. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Natchari Armarman, 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 Natchari Armarman.